Good evening. Nice to see you. On a steamy evening. As some of you know, I went through the Shuso Hosen ceremony here in late March. And that just, it's a ceremony where you become a senior student and give your first talk. And we had a week-long urban retreat, and then there's a big ceremony at the end. And during the ceremony, after the talk, there's a ritual called Dharma Combat. And the first part of that ritual is this elaborate, slow walk where the shuso or the head trainee crosses around to meet the roshi and receive the shippe, which is like a wooden sword or a staff. You know, and the roshi asks, how will you use the shippe? And the head trainee or shuso says, freely, giving life and taking it away. And then you take the shippe and you go back to the seat before you're preparing, as you're preparing for the Dharma combat. And you hold it up and these words that you're supposed to recite are, this is a 3-foot-long black snake. A long time ago, it had been a kampura flower at Mount Gudakutra. And at Mount Shorin, it had become a plum blossom. Sometimes it transforms into a dragon and swallows heaven and earth. Sometimes it transforms into a diamond sword with freedom to kill and give life. Right now, in accord with the order of my teacher, it lies in my hands. And then you say, all you dragons and elephants here, confront me in Dharma combat. And the members of the community and the students are encouraged to ask sincere questions about practice, their life, anything. And you have to respond in the moment as honestly and as immediately and as presently as you can. So it's important to note that in Zen, this metaphor of killing and reviving comes up over and over. But for me, I'd never actualized it in the way that the shuso ceremony requires one to do, which I think is the point of the ceremony. And for me, it felt like sort of jumping into this experience or being thrown into an experience of inhabiting myself as fully as possible in the moment in order to listen closely. I mean, it just puts you in the seat to do that. And, you know, best way to do it, or the challenge, I guess, is to just let go of everything that's come before. So your ideas of what you don't know, my ideas of what everyone would be thinking, how I would come across to others, how would I compare, how would my talk compare, how did my hair look, you know. Let go of that so that you can be present. Because you really want to hear what they're saying because you have to give an answer and everyone's listening to you give the answer. And you want to respond to the best of your ability without judgment or holding on or clinging to anything in that moment. And then you release that response, that interaction. You wish the person well. And you move on to the next question. And so, yeah, it's an invigorating experience because you're in the hot seat. And everyone's very actively engaged with you. And they're listening to see how you're going to do. And they're probably comparing themselves to you and they're thinking, you know, more about their own life. So it's this example of this alive interaction with others. And then after it's over, the question for me has been, so how do we do that with our day-to-day life? You know, how does that continue when we're not in the hot seat or on a pedestal or having this ritual that we're going through, just out on the street or, you know, in our own homes? And can we continue to carry that shippe with us on our daily journeys? Can we become the shippe or the staff that constantly transforms? Can we be the plum blossom or the dragon or the black snake or the diamond sword? And how do we allow that transformation to happen? In the koan, Shuzan and a staff, that question is translated like this. Master Shuzan held up her staff and, showing it to the assembled disciples, said, "You monks, if you call this a staff, you are committed to the name. If you call it not a staff, you negate the fact. Tell me, you monks, what do you call it?" And then you're supposed to respond. And the commentary echoes the koan. If you call it a staff, you're committed to the name. If you call it not a staff, you negate the fact. You cannot talk. You cannot be silent. Quick, speak. Speak, quick. How will you respond? That's the question. Fusho, not fusho. And the poem echoes the part of this chuso ceremony, or perhaps the ceremony echoes the koan. And that poem translates as, holding up a staff, she is carrying out the orders to kill and revive, where committing and negating are interfusing, Buddhas and ancestors have to beg for their lives. So holding up the staff in the Shuso ceremony and reacting one-on-one in the community in that moment for me was a literal enactment of carrying out orders to kill and revive, of living freely within the space and within the absolute and the relative in order to remain awake or to awaken. And it's very dramatic talk, obviously, to talk about killing and reviving and giving life and taking it away, but the important thing is how that translates in our own experience. And I've been thinking about the fact that it always, as always, if you analyze these ideas, you know, and the words a little too literally, they can be a trap. If you wonder how you're supposed to do it, how do you do that, you know, the absolute, how do I live in the absolute? How do I live in the relative? So Chinese Zen master Huang Po said, on no account make a distinction between the absolute and the sentient world. And we all go through our own challenges and trials and losses and hardships in our lives in our own different ways, but how do we respond to them is the important thing. And in this practice, first we sit on the cushion, and then we get up and walk out the door. And I can say, you know, sitting on the cushion for me has changed the way I walk out the door and experience my life very dramatically. That time that we spend on the cushion can help us become aware of how we respond to events in our lives. And it can create space around our thoughts and give us some breathing room and give us some time to look at what's coming up, obviously. But I would say for me, for my personality, the idea of detachment and negating the fact and pushing away is what's been very tricky because you know, you have an idea that you're supposed to let go of everything and not be attached. But it's not always the same thing as, are you letting it go or are you pushing it away? Did it dissolve and transform, or are you just not looking at it and holding it off and not wanting to go there? So my parents divorced when I was 12, and it was really hard on my mom. She became really depressed, and she sort of, I think she was a bit lost. She didn't have a job of her own. I think she'd really been raised, you know, just under this idea that she was supposed to go to college to meet a husband and become a housewife. And when that fell apart, she didn't know what her value was. So it was just me and my younger sister. She's 6 years younger than I am, which is a big difference when you're young. But I sort of fell into this role of having to be the strong one. And that's the role that I found myself playing in our family from a very young age. You know, I was sort of always aware that my parents really weren't well suited to be together, and they didn't really get along. But I wanted to kind of be the glue and keep us, you know, keep everything going. So that, I mean, it was a defense mechanism, a survival mechanism in the family dynamic. But I think definitely, you know, there was an element of pushing things away and keeping them below the surface and, you know, proving that everything was okay. I was kind of a tomboy, and I grew up in the mountains, so I always felt for some reason that I kind of had to be tough. And I think I got that from my dad, who I kind of was very close to and related to more than my mother. Subconsciously, I think I modeled myself after him. He was very kind, very gentle, kind of this hippie intellectual, very funny, smart, but definitely not good at communicating strong emotions, and definitely smothered a lot of, you know, this anger and the tough stuff. So I sort of stepped into the role of being the mom for my mom and my mom for my sister. And I really threw myself into that and, you know, trying to keep things together. I got involved in the theater, which I also think was a way of kind of escaping from what was really going on. And then my mom died of pancreatic cancer when I was 19. And at the same time, the relationship with my dad kind of fell apart. And I was, you know, very traumatized. But I just kept to what I knew as far as surviving and continuing on. And so I made myself very busy and buried a lot of my fear and grief in alcohol. And, you know, I was in lots of relationships that were all the time, but I never really let people get really close, not in an intimate way. I sort of just decided I was going to keep moving forward at all costs. You know, I think if I thought if I could negate the fact of all that pain, then everything would be all right. But, you know, pushing things away or burying them and trying to stubbornly move on doesn't necessarily make them go away or mean that they didn't happen. And of course, it can create a scenario of emotional detachment. So I think I was challenging in that way for people to get close to. And I would venture to say that because I wasn't able to be empathetic with myself, that it was hard for me to have empathy for others. So I think the idea of not being attached and, you know, cutting things off is really tricky and can be misconstrued if we're not careful. I read somewhere that you have to be attached to your emotions before you can become unattached. And I think that's something that can happen while we're on the cushion. I know that I find myself tempted to stay sitting on the pillow sometimes because it can be very tranquil and a place where I don't have to actively engage emotionally. You know, and you can get away with a lot if you're not being honest while you're meditating, because who's going to know except for you? But I am grateful for the emphasis that we have here on what we do after we get up from meditating. And I'm grateful for, you know, the combination of those two taking priority. I think the flip side, obviously, of the pushing away is how some of us respond to traumas or difficult challenges, which is by clinging too tightly to them. You know, we're committing to the name or the definition of something that's happening and clinging to it. And then we're paralyzed in the other direction, holding on too tight, refusing to let go, and sort of wallowing in whatever the situation is, and then staying in that role of like the victim of this happened to me, poor me, no one understands what I'm going through and how hard it is. Which is what I think, you know, my sister and I have talked about being two sides of the same coin, and I think her response to all of our family dynamics was kind of the opposite, holding on too tight, clinging in fear, and really not being able to let go or move forward. And we both agree it would be a lot better for both of us if we could meet in the middle. So, you know, that's this practice of how do we balance these emotions out and find the middle way. How do we do that? That's always the question. So the poet Rumi tells us, your hand opens and closes. If it were always a fist or always stretched open, you would be paralyzed. Your deepest presence is in every small contracting and expanding, the two as beautifully balanced and coordinated as birds' wings. And so I think that's the space that we can find in our practice. But it doesn't mean it's not challenging, you know. Acknowledging I have a past, I have these events and people in my life that helped shape me and affected me and who I am. Acknowledging that those things are real is important, you know. And we shouldn't negate those facts. But do they define us? Do they smother us? Or is there room to be somebody else or something else in this moment? Because what if I don't want to follow that definition of myself in that moment? Can I give myself room not to? Not to be strong? So I wasn't practicing Zen when my mother died. And I didn't have the tools to keep me present. I just definitely spiraled and went the other direction from my grief for a really long time. But I had just started practicing when my father died a few years ago, and it was a dramatic difference for me. You know, somehow I think I was able to move through that loss without becoming paralyzed. And I was able to look more honestly at the tragedy of his life and all of our lives in a way that acknowledged it without clinging to it or burying it. And I had a conversation with him like shortly before he died, and it sort of changed the way that I felt about the practice, because he was someone I'd always looked up to as a philosopher and a writer, and just this intellectual guy who had studied Eastern philosophy and I'm sure had read a lot of books about Zen, but had never really practiced. So when I told him that I had started practicing, you know, he was impressed, and he said that he had tried it once recently. And he was pretty sick at this point. He also had pancreatic cancer, which is a little strange. But it was, you know, years later after my mom did. But He said he tried it and he couldn't sit still for 5 minutes without just this experiencing excruciating agony. And I could just see by the way that he was sharing it with me that he was just suffering so much. You know, I think that he had really buried so many things so deeply that then sitting still for 5 minutes with that was too much to bear. And I stopped taking it for granted, and it just always reminds me to honor myself, and I think that we should honor ourselves for sitting for any amount of time. You know, it's easy to say, like, I've been doing this so long, I should be at this point, or I should be at that point, or I'm just a beginner, so I don't know what I'm doing, and, you know, all of that stuff, that's just your stuff. But it can be a really challenging thing, and a lot of people can't do it. And I think that it can be a matter of life and death in a way that it can affect you and transform your life. So, advice on how to do it, you know, it's like not a secret. It is a secret how it works, perhaps, for all of us because it's different for everybody. But it's not a secret. You know, committing to sit down and take the time for yourself is really, over and over, is really what it's about. I would say, there's a book called Not Always So, which is a book that was written after Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's talks from Shunryu Suzuki Roshi. And a lot of people have heard or read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, but this one, Not Always So, it was a collection of talks he gave shortly before he died, a couple years before he died. And I almost like it better. They're very simple little sweet talks, and I find them really soothing. But in one of the first ones, he gives advice, you know, for how to sit. And he says, for a period of time each day, try to sit in zazen without moving, without expecting anything, as if you were in your last moment. Moment after moment, you feel your last instant. In each inhalation and each exhalation, there are countless instants of time. Your intention is to live in each instant. First, practice smoothly exhaling. Then inhaling. Calmness of mind is beyond the end of your exhalation. If you exhale smoothly, without even trying, you're entering into the complete, perfect calmness of your mind. You do not exist anymore. When you exhale this way, then naturally your inhalation will start from there. All that fresh blood bringing everything from outside will pervade your body. You are completely refreshed. Then you start to exhale to extend that fresh feeling into emptiness. And he notes that taking care of the exhale is very important. To die, to let go, is more important than trying to be alive. Rather than trying to be active, if we can be calm and fade away into emptiness, then naturally we will be all right. Breathing out, we kill or negate the fact. Breathing in, we revive. Commit to the name. Allowing space for both of those things to happen, we continue to awaken moment by moment.